Yeah, thank you very much. I'm really glad I have the opportunity to tell you about our recent results on this problem. I should maybe say that we have been working on condor physics in different contexts for many years. Maybe the last 10 years or so, we have been interested in heavy fermion systems and even single impurity condor problems, multi-channel condor problems, and so on. But recently, we got interested in the problem of transport through quantum dots, which can be described by Anderson models, and that's what I want to tell about today. So I would like to address three particular points that have not been discussed during last week's lectures. We've already had two talks on this subject. And these are, what happens to the condor effect if you have a multi-orbital Anderson model, if you not only have one energy level, but you have several? And of course, that's the usual case. You have several levels in the quantum dot. And I'm going to show that then you get satellite condor resonance peaks above the Fermi energy and below the Fermi energy. These, of course, are not so easily observed experimentally, but they are there. And if one can think of some spectroscopic experimental device, then they can be measured. Secondly, I would like to discuss transport through atomic break junctions, which has been discussed last week by Jan van Reutenbeck, where he has shown that there is some kind of quantization of the conductance observed. There's some tendency that the conductance is close to a unit or several units of the quantum conductance. And this can be a consequence of correlation effects on the atom. Okay, and secondly, and thirdly, I would like to talk about non-equilibrium condor physics. There's been some discussion recently that maybe at large bias voltage, a quantum dot may go into a new fixed point. A two-channel, some people say four-channel condor model fixed point, and I'll discuss this. My collaborators on this are Hans Kruha, who has been here last week and has left already, Achim Roche, and a graduate student, Stefan Kirchner. Before I start, let me remind you briefly about condor physics in general. Any quantum dot with interactions is some type of impurity model and can be described as the appropriate Anderson impurity model. So you have some levels on the dot, you have a Coulomb interaction, you have some coupling to the leads, to the electrons out here. And that's the typical situation that one has for a magnetic ion in a metal. And it has been studied for 30 years and gives rise to the so-called condor effect. So what's the condor effect? If you look at the local electron spectral function, then you get, of course, the peaks that are due to these levels here on the dot, which is the level that you had to begin with, the level that you get when you switch on the Coulomb interaction, which is epsilon d plus u. So these two are broadened by the escape rate, by the coupling to the leads, of course. Broadening out called gamma as usual. But there's an addition at the Fermi energy, which I will take to be at zero, a peak, condor resonance peak, I'll call it, with a typical width tk. So this resonance peak appears under certain conditions, namely when the bare level width gamma is much less than the distance of the level to the Fermi energy here, or the one up here, it doesn't matter. And the resonance width is given by this famous expression, which is an exponential expression in the parameters epsilon d over gamma. When the condor effect takes place, the occupation of the local level is close to one. And because of the Coulomb interaction, there cannot be more than roughly one electron on the dot, because it's energetically too costly to put another electron which would have to go up here. So under these conditions, when there is approximately one electron on the dot, we have a single electron with spin 1/2, and we can describe the dot by an impurity spin, a local spin, s equals 1/2. We can eliminate the part of the Hilbert space that concerns empty levels and doubly occupied levels. And if we do this projection onto the Hilbert space of singly occupied levels by a Schrieffer-Wolf transformation, we get to the usual condo model. So now let's assume that we have not only one level on this dot, but we have several. Let's start with two. So we have an Anderson model, which is described by a conduction electron part, a hybridization part, or hopping part, here, this one, and the level energy up here. We assume for simplicity that the Coulomb interaction is infinitely strong. So then we know that there's a constraint on the occupation number. The occupation can be at most one, and it will be usually a little bit less than one. So these two levels, epsilon d1 and epsilon d2, they are coupled to the conduction electrons, and they will be broadened. I've indicated this broadening here by this green line, so this is supposed to be the spectral function. And the broadening
on each level or on both levels? You have also Coulomb repulsion between the two levels?
Yeah, the Coulomb repulsion is between all electrons on the dot. So if the electron is on level 1 or on level 2, it doesn't matter. I take the same Coulomb repulsion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so what will happen? So we know that if there's only one level, we get the condo resonance. So what will happen when we have two levels? So we can get an idea of what will happen by doing Slave boson mean field theory. So we introduce a pseudo-particle representation for the local electron. We introduce fermions for the case that the dot is singly occupied. We introduce one boson for the case that it's empty. We can rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of this auxiliary particle operators in this way. We have to make sure that the constraint is satisfied, and that means that the sum of the occupation numbers of the pseudo-fermions and the slave bosons has to be equal to 1. So this we enforce by adding this Lagrange multiplier term here. And then we do mean field theory, that is, we assume that the bosons are condensed and the Bose operator can be replaced by its expectation value, which we call B0. And we assume that the constraint that this charge is equal to 1 is obeyed on the average only. And this will fix the Lagrange parameter lambda naught. And then what happens is that the levels epsilon dm are renormalized. And they are shifted upwards by an amount lambda naught. So there's one energy shift here. It's lambda naught for both levels. This energy shift is such that the lower level here will be shifted up to the Fermi energy. And if you look here in this expression, if you replace B by B naught, then of course what you get is a resonance level model with a reduced hopping rate, which is V times B naught. And this is just the renormalized width of the level, the condo resonance width, which is of order pk. So what we expect is to get two peaks, two condo resonance peaks, one at the Fermi level, as always, and one shifted above the Fermi level by an amount which corresponds to the difference here of these two energies. If we think of a finite temperature situation where the upper level here is occupied to some extent, we can also get the third resonance, namely below the Fermi energy here, which is proportional to the thermal occupation of this level up here. We have calculated these satellite resonance peaks by using the NCA non-crossing approximation. And we actually did it not for a quantum dot, but for a heavy fermion system for cerium copper 2 silicon 2. And the cerium atoms are the magnetic ions in this case. In this case, one has a complicated multiplet structure on the magnetic ion. There's some crystal field split set of lower levels. There's a spin orbit splitting here, and there's some other levels here. And these levels here produce satellite peaks, as you can see here. So you get these two here that are separated by this small amount. They give rise to this peak that's very close to the actual condor resonance. This other group here leads to this peak. So this is a blow up. This is basically an expanded version here. And here you can see this shoulder, which is sort of the mirror image of this one. This is the thermally occupied thing. Okay, so how to observe this? This is, of course, not so simple, because usually one can observe the condor resonance in transport measurements, so in low energy measurements. But here you would have to have a spectroscopic tool. Yeah?
I'm sorry. The width of this E level, is it of the same order as the D? It's also of the order of quantum temperature?
It's a little bit, I mean, it depends. It's of the order of the condor temperature with a factor that depends on the actual coupling. I mean, the coupling, the gammas, of course, are different for the different levels. They enter as a prefactor in the width, but the scale is set by the condor temperature. And the fact that they are here appear a little bit broader is due to the splitting here, because we have a cold group of levels.
But can it be detected by the phase measurements? So you know that there is some strange result that the phase changes not by phi.
You mean it's the change that's normally close to pi over 2 for a condor resonance, is that changed by these satellite peaks? That will be changed, but of course when the satellite peaks are well separated, then the change will be small. So the effect on the transport properties, I'm afraid, is not very, very large. Now, the reason why we did this calculation was because there are photo emission experiments on cerium copper 2 silicon 2 that are now so refined that they can actually see the condor resonance peak. So what they do, of course, in photo emission, you can only see the states below the Fermi energy. But at finite temperature, you have a little bit of tail here that that reaches into the positive energy space. And what they do is they measure very precisely here, out here, then they divide by the Fermi function. And in this way, they get the part of the spectrum for positive energies. And this is what is being done here. Of course, that works well for higher energies, where you can go farther, like here. It works, it's increasingly more difficult for lower energy. And here, for instance, for the lowest energy, 15K, you can only see the condor peak here. But this is already a spurious, not to be taken seriously. But if you compare with the NCA results up here, you can see that at, say, 105K, where there's this double peak structure, you can see an indication of this double peak structure in the data. So it's there. I mean, these peaks are there. And they also claim to see this shoulder here, this here. This would be a little shoulder here. OK, anyway. So this effect should be present in quantum dots as well. And if one could do spectroscopic measurements of quantum dots, then one should be able to see this. And one possibility to do such measurements would be to measure transport of hot electrons. If you inject hot electrons, electrons that are above the Fermi energy by a sufficient amount, measure the transport, then it would be possible to see this these resonances. And I've been told that that's, in principle, that's possible.
And now you were looking at a local spectral function, theoretically, were you?
Right.
And the experiments are not angle-resolved, I assume, for emission.
Yeah.
Can they do angle-resolved for emission on these heavy fermion materials or not?
They, at least they can, of course, but they haven't done it. They haven't done that so far. So here the idea is, of course, this is a heavy fermion material, and this is a Kondo lattice or Anderson lattice system. But the idea is to say that these features are basically single ion features. So you can apply a single ion theory to describe this stuff. That's this one more step in between, but that seems to work.
Just to make sure that the words, when you say hot electrons, you don't mean a very non-linear transport.
No, no. What I mean is a beam. Yeah, yeah.
At that energy.
At some energy. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yes. Now there are lots of questions. Yeah.
I mean, there was some experiment, of course, seeing signature of this Kondo resonance. I mean, but you say that, I mean, if you have more than one satellite, I mean, more than one resonance, it's not something that should be seen in the conductance.
In the conductance, I mean, in order to see that, you would have to crank up the temperature so much that you cover the energy spacing of the two peaks, and that would wash out the Kondo resonance. Then you would have to have to use a temperature that's too large. That's the problem. That there is some possibility. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. 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 Yeah. If you apply a magnetic field, you get a splitting. Sure. You are talking about applying a magnetic field that's so large that you can bring the upper peak down closer to the Fermi energy, something like this.
No, you have a single complex. Let's say you just have a single level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In your case, you know, there are two levels which are split to begin with.
Okay.
So it's like a, in some sense, a system which is already in magnetic field. So the magnetic field does not quench the Kondo resonance because it's the levels of the generator. Nevertheless, you're splitting, and it's very similar to that.
Uh-huh.
Single Kondo level magnetic field.
Uh-huh.
This has been observed, I mean,
yeah.
Called by nonlinear IV.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good suggestion, actually. I think what we should do is to calculate the transport for nonlinear voltage. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good. We'll do that. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let me now switch to the second part, atomic break junctions. So you've, I think, all seen these pretty pictures. Here is this nanostructure, and here is the break junction. So if this thing is pushed from below, then it will separate, and you will get a situation like this, ideally, where you have only a single atom through which the transport takes place. And typical results for this experiment look like so. So this is the conductance as a function of the separation, or as a function of the time, because this is done continuously, doesn't matter. Up here, the total conductance. And you see when the thing is relatively thick, you get a conductance which is, say, four here, then it's decreases. And shortly before it breaks here, you get a conductance that's approximately one quantum unit here. So this is one trace. Now, typically what they see is that this is not very reproducible. If you do it many, many times, every time you find a somewhat different situation that depends on the configuration of the atoms and so on. So it's not very, very easy to control the exact configuration. But what they find, nonetheless, is that there is a tendency to observe. Let's look at the lowest part, this part here, to observe kind of a quantization, to observe one quantum of resistance. And that's strange, because if you think about it, you would expect all kinds of transition probabilities. especially if you start to separate, you would think that the transition probability would go down, and you would get all kinds of values there. But nonetheless, there's this tendency. So there's the next. Yeah. All the time is that if you do this continuously, you just, you know.
I mean, it's the same sample, right?
It's one sample. One sample. This is just one trace. You just do it one. This is just one single trace. You start with the contact, and then you separate. You apply your pressure, and as a function of time, the thing starts to. And then there are glitches. Here, something. There's some atomic reconfiguration, and here there's some atomic reconfiguration, and here you would think, aha, now we are down at one atom. That's one atom is making the contact here in this region. Okay, now the interesting thing is that in aluminum, this is for aluminum, Elkischer and her collaborators, they have managed to measure the individual transmission channels. Aluminum has 1s and 3p states, and three of these orbitals couple to the leads. Three of the orbitals coupled to the leads, that's the number three here. And by cooling the system down so that the aluminum becomes superconducting, they get, of course, a gap. I mean, they get, of course, some structure. And they measure sub-gap structures. And the sub-gap structures are determined by the Andreev reflection of the quasi-particles on this dot. So there are, you can distinguish Andreev reflections. They're going once, so back and forth, or two times, or three times. And by doing this, you get a sequence of, I don't have the data here, I'm just, so that's not my point, really. So you get a sequence of thresholds, and by fitting these thresholds to the theory, you can determine the individual transmission coefficients. And this is shown here. So here are the individual transmission coefficients for the three channels, let's say. And they add up to the total here. And the strange thing is, and that's my point, that the sum of these three adds up to something which is close to one, whereas the individual transmission coefficients are far from being one, as you see. I mean, they are 0.1, 0.24, anything. Of course, it's not precise. It's not quantization in the exact sense. But there's a tendency that this is close to one. And this tendency comes out much more clearly when one measures many, many samples, 10,000. Not samples, but 10,000 times. Yeah. No, they just look for channels. They just do this analysis of the subgap structure, allowing for so and so many channels, and they find that they get the best fit by having three channels, exactly three channels. And that's okay if you look at the atomic physics. That's okay. That's what you expect. So they get these histograms here, number of counts of conductance. As a function of conductance, and you see there are these peaks. There's a peak here, it's a little bit less than one here, 0.8. There's another peak here that's a little bit less than two, and so on. But there are these peaks. So it's not a completely smooth function. There are these clear peaks. There's a tendency for the conductance to be quantized. Okay.
I have a question. This transmission, individual transmission probability, like
yeah.
You mentioned.
Yeah.
What defines the representation here? I mean, you have some transmission maker.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, of course, the quantum chemistry, and that's not so well known. I mean, you have these atomic states, and the atomic states are coupled to the lead channels in some way.
There's a fitting bar, right? So how many free parameters are going to fit? As far as I understand, they assume that there are only three free parameters, so they assume basically that there's no scattering between the different channels. But of course, if you would...
No, that's not the way...
principal approach, you would have a transmission matrix, you would have many more than just...
Yeah, no, that's not the point. No. You can do this fit you allow for five or six channels, and you do the fit, and you find that they're exactly three. Okay? You can fit the data best by having just three channels going through
the three channels, you have a 3x3 transmission matrix.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you get three numbers, what are those numbers of all three squares?
The eigenvalues. That are the eigenvalues of the transmission matrix.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
As far as I understand, the semiconductor, I mean, in the conductance is different. The conductance depends only on the eigenvalues. So whatever the matrix is,
right,
you're only three parameters. As far as I understand, this multiple invariant complexion depends not just on the eigenvalues, but also on the eigenvectors. And so in order to reduce the problem to having only three fit parameters, they have to assume that the transmission matrix is the animal, and so that there's no scattering between.
No,
those.
It's not only three fit parameters. They allow for more fit parameters, and they find that they just get the best fit, and they only have three channels. That's how I understand it. So you're saying if I also change the eigenvectors,
yes,
can I get a better fit?
Have a 3x3 matrix.
But they use the optimal eigenvectors and they get, yeah.
I always understood that this was somehow a weakness of the approach.
Uh-huh.
That with invariant reflection, unfortunately, the IV characteristic which they measure does not depend only on the eigen channels and the eigenvalues,
mm-hmm,
which are only three, but also on more information on the structure of this matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And they somehow assume that these different channels are not coupled so that they can really treat them as separate.
Now, in these Andreev reflection experiments, I mean, in the theory, what you get is that you have, if you have n reflections, you measure the nth power of this particular eigenvalue of the transmission matrix. Yeah. Okay. So now let me. Pardon?
You have a
It's a kind of proximity effect situation. I mean, you have a situation where you have a potential for the quasi particles in the gap, and so you get Andreev reflection at this point. So. Okay, now let me come to my point. So. We would like to model this by an Anderson model with these several orbitals. So in this case, if there are three channels, I would like to take three orbitals into account. The point is now, if we know that this Anderson model has a Fermi liquid ground state, then we know what the local electron Green's function that we need to calculate the conductance looks like. There's this form. They've done it for two orbitals. So here we have the transmission matrix coefficients here, gammas, and we have the sigmas, the self energies due to the Coulomb interaction on the atom, on this atom. And we know that the imaginary part of the self energies at low temperature and low energy go as omega squared plus T squared. And we also know that the occupation numbers for spin up and spin down are given by the determinant of this matrix, the inverse matrix Green's function in this way. Okay, now if we use the general expression for the conductance due to Meyer and Wingren up here involving the trace of the matrix gamma times the matrix G and the imaginary part of it, derivative of a Fermi function, integral over omega. And we are interested in low temperature, temperatures much less than the Kondo temperature, let's say, where we can treat this derivative as a delta function and pull out this part at omega equals zero, then we can just reformulate this function here that determines the conductance by using the definition of ND that I showed before in this way. So this is an exact rewriting of this expression, So we get the first term that involves the sine squared of pi n d sigma. Second term has a prefactor sine of 2 pi n d sigma. And if n d sigma is close to 1/2, so that the total n d is close to 1, then of course this first term is close to 1, and this term is 0. So the conductance would be approximately 1, even though the individual contributions from the individual channels are not 1, of course. They add up to 1. And this also holds for a larger number of orbitals, 3 or so. And what we need is that the gammas are typically less than the distance of the levels to the Fermi energy. That's the usual condition for the Kondo effect to take place.
This is an explanation for why you have this miraculous conspiracy that you have a lot of curved channels.
Right.
They all combine to give one.
Yeah. It's a type of Friedel-Sum rule argument.
And you need to be below the common temperature.
Yeah. That's correct.
Is that realistic in these experiments? Are they below the common temperature?
Yeah, I mean, to really know the common temperature, you would have to know what the couplings, I mean, the hopping elements are in this regime. And that's not known. It's very hard to say, because when you would have to know how far the central atom is separated from the next neighbors in order to estimate this hopping.
But that's a theoretical answer. The question is, experimentally, can you tell if they are below the condo?
They have not measured. They have not measured. Have not looked. They have not looked for condo effect.
Is that not an evolution for a triangle?
Well, I mean, if anything, we would expect that the condo temperature is relatively high. Okay, because the coupling is still very, very good. We are not expecting a Kondo effect that takes place at very low temperature.
This is, of course, a beautiful fundamental explanation, because there have been other attempts which try to really invoke the fact that somehow this contact stabilizes, not just by changing its transmission coefficients, but there's also, of course, a mechanical aspect to it.
Like
you have to ask what is the ideal configuration, and that somehow by a coupling between transport and some structural stability, you would find a conductance, a transmission, basically a conspiracy to get a full channel.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that this is sort of for sure the correct explanation. I'm just saying that as a consequence of correlations, you can get this type of quantization. And that's, I think, a candidate theory. And of course, one should look experimentally for signatures of the Kondo effect in these systems, like the temperature dependence, for instance.
Probably we must assume that the Kondo temperature is larger than the superconducting temperature. Otherwise,
yeah,
if it goes superconducting, you lose the Kondo effect.
Okay.
The whole analysis would break down.
That's right. That's correct, too. Yeah.
So
that's correct. So the Kondo temperature has to be several tens of Kelvin. Yeah.
Kelvin.
Yeah. I don't know any experimental results for the temperature dependence of that. But you're right. That's something one should, of course, check. Distinguishing feature. Yeah.
Can you explain both the first step in the unit conductance, but all the others that you behave with addition of unit conductance?
Explain what that?
In the experiment, the histogram you have shown, it looks like not only the first step is counted as unit conductance, but the others also count as the same.
Okay. So now let me. So the point is, of course, that if you have the situation here, so you are starting with a good contact and you have larger conductance than unity here, that means that you have more than one atom making the contact. And that's what they think. I mean, they think if they do the other thing, say they sort of come from this side here, then what usually happens is that the contact is made with exactly one atom. That's this result here. Then as you go closer, there's another point where a second contact arises, or a third one, and so on. Okay? And these are usually not close by, as far as I understand. As much as one knows, they are usually not close by, but they are, because there's a certain surface, and you approach, and you get one, two, three, and so on. Okay. So this I would, theoretically, I would describe these by saying I have independent contributions, so just have a superposition of sort of parallel conductance channels. And if you do that, if you assume that...
let's assume that those contacts are not made by two adjacent atoms, two atoms that are placed some random way.
Yeah. If we assume that, if we do this calculation, we calculate this using the non-crossing approximation, again, we find a histogram which has these peaks, but that really only tells you that for a large space of a fraction of parameter space, you are at the Kondo regime, and there you would have this tendency to unique conductors. So this is now a superposition of one contact, two contacts, three contacts, and so on. And here again is the histogram. So I only want to say that you can get this type of behavior if you use this consequence of correlation physics here. Whether this can be explained by some structural physics, as you point out, that's of course also a possibility. But by doing these measurements at higher temperature, one should be able to see whether this goes away.
But it tells not quite much. And if you look at the way the peaks, it looks like.
Yeah. Oh, this. Yeah, this.
On the left side.
Yeah, this depends. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the theoretical model, of course, in the absence of knowing anything about the real atomic structure and wave functions, we just assume that the gamma, some of the gamma matrix, has statistical elements. So we just pick the gamma nm statistically in a certain range.
You mean random?
Random. Just a random. Yeah, random choice. Yeah. And there is probably some correlation. And we have some contacts with quantum chemists that may help us to get some more information on the real. On the values of these gammas, but I'm not too hopeful, I have to say, that one can really control the situation for this reason, because one doesn't know the structure.
Sorry, just a question of scale. Maybe it's not relevant, but suppose that the two atoms that were forming were really very close to each other. So, so in some sense, it would behave like an atom with two levels.
Yeah.
And I think we have told us before that an atom with two levels will give a single Kondo peak at Fermi and satellite peak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to observe this, the atoms somehow must be, I guess, separated enough so that they behave like two independent Kondo centers.
Yeah. Let's say. Yeah. That's
for that,
right.
Probably they must be further than some length, which might be the Kondo scale or the VF.
No, not Kondo scale. Not Kondo scales. Just some atomic scale. I mean,
just atomic scale.
Yeah.
So they will not overlap.
Yeah.
The electronic wave function.
Right. Yeah. So that would be enough. I mean, this picture. What we're assuming is that the hopping elements are between the central atom or the two central atoms, and the leads are smaller. Of course, are smaller than the hoppings in the bulk metal, and it depends on how much they are smaller. if they are sufficiently smaller, then this type of physics should take place, because then you will get the correlation effects. If they are not, then there's no quantum effect. It's quite clear. Okay, let me now come to the third topic, condo effect at high bias voltage. So we again assume we have a condo, a quantum dot here with one level now, and we apply a finite bias voltage we are working again at infinite Coulomb repulsion on the dot, so that the occupation number is less than one. Okay, under these circumstances, if the, as I explained before, if we are really in a condo a little bit, we can map this model onto a spin exchange model of this type. So we have various couplings. We have a coupling of the local spin to the spins in the left lead, the spins the right lead, and we also have a mixed coupling. That's the important point here. We also have a coupling to a spin which is composed of a particle hole pair, where the particle is on the left and the hole is on the right. Now, out of the Anderson model, we can only get coupling constants here if you have symmetry, if left and right is the same. We can only get symmetric coupling. So all the J's are equal in the Anderson model. But there may be other realizations where you can get different, in that case I will discuss. So then we have condo effect, we have the dynamically generated energy scale, T condo, again. And what I'm going to discuss is that the conductance is a universal function of temperature and voltage, in the way that it's only a function of V over TK and P over TK. The main difference of this situation compared to the situation with small voltage is that a finite bias voltage opens a phase space for inelastic scattering even at temperature zero. Because, of course, even at temperature zero, we can get electrons to move across here from the upper to the lower reservoir. You get an inelastic scattering rate, which in lowest order perturbation theory is given by J left right squared times the voltage. So even at T equals zero, you have inelastic scattering. Okay. And you have this inelastic scattering when you have a finite current, because in order to have a finite current, you need JLR to be finite. So if there's a finite current, and that's the situation we are interested in, there is a finite inelastic scattering rate. And this inelastic scattering rate destroys the quantum coherence necessary for the condo effect. And basically, this gamma, or some renormalized version of it, introduces an infrared cutoff in the renormalization group flow. So we have studied this with, again, with the non-crossing approximation, now the non-equilibrium version of the non-crossing approximation, and with renormalization group methods. So in this case, the non-crossing approximation, we have to take into account that we have non-equilibrium electrons. So these lines are now carry the occupation numbers with the corresponding Fermi energies on the left and on the right. That's a very important point. And the inelastic scattering appears as the imaginary part of the pseudo-fermion self-energy in lowest order, for instance. So this would be this diagram, where this is the conduction electron line and this is the slave boson line. We should not use bare perturbation theory, which is up here, but we should use renormalized perturbation theory. That is to say, we sum the leading logarithms and we replace JLR by this expression here. This amounts to replacing the J by 1 over log voltage over contour temperature. Okay, now the question is this justified? And in order to be able to say something about that, we look at the effective coupling, the effective exchange coupling that we get in this picture. The effective exchange coupling is given by this expression here. This is a slave boson Green's function here, and that controls the coupling. And in this renormalized perturbation theory regime, this Green's function is given by this expression, simple expression here. And you see there are singularities at omega equals plus V over 2 and omega equals minus V over 2, but they are damped. They are cut off by gamma here in these terms. Nonetheless, if you study this denominator here, you find that it has zeros if gamma, the damping constant, is less than a certain scale, T star, and this scale is T condo squared over V. So if gamma would be less than T star, this expression would start to develop poles, and that would be the end of the renormalized perturbation theory. Then we would have to go on, we would have to go, we would have to treat this problem as a strong coupling problem. But if that's not the case, if gamma is much larger than T star, we are safe, because this effective coupling is finite, and it's small, and it doesn't grow, and therefore everything is okay. Now, using the expression for gamma I showed you before, in this valid in this regime, in this renormalized perturbation theory regime, this expression here, by comparing it with T star, you find that this is very well satisfied. Gamma is much larger than T star. So there should not be a problem. The conductance would then be given by J effective squared, which is 1 over log squared V over TK. And by doing
differential conductance.
Differential conductance, yeah. Differential conductance, yeah. And by doing the So by doing the full solution of the NCA equations, we find that this is the case. So we get here gamma over TK as a function of V over TK. These are these points here. And here I've indicated the expression for T star. And you see that for V over TK larger than 1, or say larger than 10, so from this regime on here, gamma is much larger than T star, and this condition is satisfied. You can also see that the scaling is working. So these are results for different condo temperatures here, and they all fall on top of each other here. Also shown is the conductance here, the differential conductance. And this is this 1 over log squared behavior down here for large V. We've also looked at the spectral function. Spectral function should be a function of omega over V and TK over V only in this regime. And we find two logarithmically diverging peaks at omega equals plus minus V over 2 at large V. And these peaks are smeared out by gamma in a certain way. So that you find here Yeah. For various values of V over TK, so this is 1, 2, 5, 10, 100, 500, you find that this single peak at small voltage decreases and a second peak at minus 1/2 V appears here. So that for really large voltage, by 1,000 times TK, you get this double peak structure very nicely. Pardon? I didn't, sorry. Oh, this is done by NCA. This is done with just solving the NCA equations, the non-equilibrium NCA equations. Okay, now, some time ago, Wen and later Coleman and collaborators argued that this problem might be very interesting because it might have a second fixed point in the limit where JLR is less than JL, in the limit where the coupling between the leads sort of is less than the coupling of the spin to the left or right lead individually. And we were just looking at the question whether this is possible or when something might happen there. This is a slightly theoretical discussion now because it's not known, or at least there are no good ideas at the moment, how one can actually realize this situation, how one can realize a quantum dot where JLR is much less than JL or JR. But there are some ideas around, use two quantum dots coupled or use higher spin or something. Okay. So what we do is, to analyze this, is we use Poor-Mann scaling for this case. So we have two coupling constants. We have a coupling constant for the L corresponding to JRR or JLL. I put those equal to one another, so we use a completely symmetric situation. And we have a coupling constant JLR, which is this GLR. And the Renorm group equations are these. And these equations, they have an invariant here, and that's GD squared minus GLR squared over 2 GLR, we call alpha. And this alpha is a constant under this Renorm group flow. These are the equations for large cutoff. If the cutoff lambda is much larger than the voltage, we get this situation. So there's only a single running coupling constant, which is the sum GD plus GLR. That's the usual Kondo coupling, and we get the usual behavior here, producing the Kondo temperature and so on. We can calculate these two coupling constants at the lower end of this regime, so for lambda of the order of V, and these are the expressions, and they depend on the value of alpha naught here. The value of alpha naught is determined by the difference between JLR and JR. So alpha naught is equal to zero if we are in the completely symmetric situation. If JLR is equal to JR, which is the case I discussed in the beginning, alpha naught would be zero, and I would have the situation that I discussed. So I have, basically, one can stay in the perturbative regime, and one never enters the strong coupling regime. Okay, so what happens for a smaller lambda? So if we scale through the point lambda approximately V. Well, we can continue the scaling down to the scale gamma. At gamma, we know, we have shown, that the renormalization group flow stops because these inelastic processes will cut off any further infrared physics at this scale. But in this regime, the flow of GLR already stops. Because in this regime, in order to have renormalization of GLR, we would have to have processes taking an electron from one side to the other side. These processes require a minimal energy of V. And if the cutoff, the energy cutoff is less than V, then these processes can no longer take place. So we have this equation now, and we have the usual equation for GD. And we know that this equation tells us that the coupling flows to strong coupling fixed point. Now, if GD is of order 1, which when we enter the strong coupling regime, we can define the characteristic energy scale, which is given by this. And you see, if alpha naught is actually 0, so if we have the situation where JLR is equal to JR, then we just recover our old friend T star from before, and nothing much happens. However, if alpha naught is finite, and because of this factor log V over TK that we have up here, we can get into a situation where this T star is larger, and where the situation gamma over T star is larger than 1 is no longer satisfied. So roughly for alpha naught of order unity, or say greater than 1/2, we get gamma over T star to be much less than 1 for not so large voltage in a range where V is much less than a certain V star, which depends on TK, of course. And this V star is, for instance, if alpha naught is equal to 1, then this characteristic scale would be of the order of 10 to the 5 TK. That's a pretty high scale. There's a large scale of voltage here involved where this can take place. So then, in this regime, gamma is small, and alpha flows in this regime to larger values, such that alpha of T star is given by alpha naught log square V over TK. So if you have a V over TK of, say, 1,000, you get 50 alpha naught here. So you get an effective alpha parameter, which is rather large. And if alpha is rather large, it means that you are close to the two-channel situation. Because what does it mean? If alpha is large, if alpha is large, which means GLR is small, it means JLR is small. If JLR goes to 0, we have a decoupled situation. The system couples separately to the left, to the right channel, and we have a two-channel Kondo problem. The question is that we are discussing here is, can it happen that the JLR under the renormalization group flow flows to very, very large values? And if it does, then we are close to the two-channel physics. So our conclusion here is that we can actually get, even for a relatively small alpha naught, which is the value of alpha to begin with, for a relatively small alpha naught of order 1, let's say, we can get large values of alpha under the renormal group flow, which means that we have two-channel Kondo physics in this regime, for a certain regime. What happens beyond that? What happens if GD scales to large coupling? We don't know. And we also know for sure that eventually the flow will be cut off by gamma, by the scale gamma. But there may be a certain window of voltages and temperatures where two-channel physics may be observable for a model which is prepared in such a way that JLR is sufficiently less than JRR. Okay, so there has been some discussion, especially with Piers Coleman, on this, and the argument there was that they calculated the spin susceptibility, the total spin susceptibility, and they claimed to show that in second order in J, one did not see any effect of the of this gamma, of these inelastic processes. And we have recently, actually, since I'm here, I've calculated the local spin susceptibility for also in second order in J, and what at finite voltage, and what I find is that the local spin susceptibility is given by this expression, which for small v, of course, is Curie, and for large v is just 1 over the voltage. So the degeneracy, the spin degeneracy that gives rise to the 1 over temperature behavior in the susceptibility is washed out by these inelastic processes, and you get 1 over the energy scale of these processes, which is 1 over V. And that, in my opinion, means that also in higher order, where you would see the log terms appearing, in this order you don't see the log terms yet, you have to go to fourth order in J to see the log terms, that there you would find that all the logs are cut off by gamma. Okay, so let me summarize. I've discussed three questions here. The first was that if one has a multi-orbital Anderson model, one can observe condor resonance satellites. And yeah, I think that might be an interesting interesting feature to look for if one had a possibility to do spectroscopy on these quantum dots. And secondly, I discussed a possibility to explain a approximate quantization of the conductance through quantum point contacts by correlation effects. And thirdly, I was discussing the scaling behavior of the conductance in a finite bias voltage quantum dot, and the question of a new 2 or even 4 channel fixed point in the system. So, thank you.
You had some discussion, perhaps there's
another question concerning point 1. In order to see these side peaks, you need the quantum number symmetry of the channel is not conserved.
So you need the
levels coupled to the same channel.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, if they were coupled to different channels, this would be. Then it's getting into the two-channel physics category. So then you have an asymmetric sort of a not perfect two-channel problem. But you should also expect peaks, resonance peaks. So.
Not really a question, it comes for you. I'm not going forward on the audience. I heard that this is connected to question subject number 2. I heard a talk, I think, several years ago by Nico Garcia, I believe. And he looked at the wave jump. If I'm not mistaken. And you look just at the statistics of conductance across this wave junction, and you got peaks in the distribution at integer values of this total wave. I think my recollection of this description and it certainly has nothing to do with even, I don't even see how quantum effects come.
Well, of course, but you have to ask the question, if I don't see all of them,
Yeah, but I think that somebody here maybe is more detrimental than I do.
I mean, there's one thing one can say, that there are quite different results for different metals. I've shown you aluminum because aluminum goes superconducting, and you can do this Andreev reflection analysis. But if you look at other metals like niobium, I recall now, or some others, you don't see this very regular distribution of peaks. Sometimes the first peak is missing, there's some peak later, so there are all kinds of shapes. So what I'm saying here is certainly not a universal model to explain all of these experiments, but in some cases it may be maybe the right physics. No, I don't know. I don't know. We have heard about noise measurements last week in Jan van Reutenbeck's talk.
And last week, he actually discussed something else, discussing fluctuation of functional voltage. The time dependent fluctuations have also been studied. Oh. And analyzed in pretty much the same way.
For the noise? Yeah, well, I mean, I would think that there should be some effect too. It's always hard, it's hard to tell whether you get this same kind of quantization, because it depends on some conditions. Like you saw, I mean, in this expression for the conductance in terms of where I had this sine, pi, nd, and so on, it's not automatic that you get a situation where all the terms drop out. So I don't know what would happen for the shot noise.
I have a kind of general question. It's probably stupid, mostly a statement of about my ignorance about quantum physics and quantum dots. But in this Anderson model, we have an impurity embedded in the sea of electrons. Here, the impurity, I should think of the impurity of quantum dot is the impurity with this level. But the sea of electrons is separated from this because this is in the limits. So I somehow don't see clearly. It doesn't make any change because you just write down directly the Anderson model.
That doesn't make any difference. I mean, whether you couple the original magnetic ion to the electrons on the same atom, so you have on the same atom you have conduction electron levels and you have d electron levels or f electron levels, or whether you couple to the neighbors via some hopping, that doesn't matter. It's the same physics.
And why it is so crucial to have just one electron on the dot, as you were saying? If I have many, but the total spin is still 1/2.
Oh no, that's just an abstraction. Of course, you can have as many electrons as you want when they are in singlet states. That's okay. I mean, they don't harm. I mean, that's okay.
The Fermi level is where? The Fermi level is determined by the leads.
Yeah, that's right. Normally, what one says is that the highest level, which is closest below but closest to the Fermi energy, that's the important level, and all the other levels are left out, because all the other levels are doubly occupied anyway, and so that.
Yeah, but in the evening, just in continuation to this, so you really assume only the resonance between a single electron in the dot and the conduction. You don't take the whole dot as an interacting state, you know, with speed 1/2.
Yeah, well, that's because if the Coulomb interaction is so high, then and I have some sort of ground state on the dot where there may be 1 million electrons, but I'm only interested in the structure and the level structure, you know, up the uppermost levels. And I don't expect, that's the model assumption. I don't expect that if I add one more electron, that I get a large rearrangement in the dot. But if you have a degenerate situation, that's a different thing. If you have a degenerate situation on the dot and you add one electron and you get a big change there, that can happen, I think. Then you would have to model.
What if I spin
3 half? If you spin 3 halves, no problem. Then you do a spin 3 half contour model. That's okay.
I just wanted to return to the scale question. Again, the same apologetic remarks as Boris made. Suppose we have the contact is formed by two atoms with a lateral separation d, larger than atomic scale.
Mm-hmm.
Now, each of these two atoms makes a condo cloud, you know, of the conduction electrons, which make the singlet state with the condo guy on that atom. And if these condo clouds strongly overlap, and I think the scale for that is probably this distance Vf over tk, then you would expect that somehow there'll be strong interaction of the two condo centers. And somehow we know that when they really get together and become one super atom, they told that there is only one condo resonance. So I think there is a question, namely, on what scale do you have to put the two atoms apart in order to have two independent condo behaviors? Maybe the same question applies to different condo impurities in a solid, you know, in a bulk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There is a scale somehow. Yeah. It must be looked enough.
But the point is that the sort of the obvious scale that you just mentioned, the Vf over TK, that's usually a very long scale, a very large scale.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of angstroms.
Thousands of angstroms, letter spacings. And that apparently is not the scale that where the condor, two condor ions interfere. So there are experiments in dilute magnetic alloys where you have, say, what do they usually have, ppm, in three dimensions, so you get every 100th atom is a magnetic ion, and you can see beautiful single ion behavior. So that also don't the seem they don't seem to.
Right. Also, the size effect doesn't agree with that.
So there is.
But there must be some scale.
I think the reason is that most of the screening happens very close to the spin. When we have calculated some time ago, we have calculated the extension, so the shape of the screening cloud, and this shape is so that very close to the spin you have most of this screening cloud, and then there's the extends with a low amplitude to farther out.
What is the length scale for this inhomogeneity?
The length scale is atomic. It's basically a few lattice sites. A few lattice sites you get most of the.
That's genuine, right?
Yeah, that's what we found, at least.
Dear friends, it's 12:15. Several people are leaving already. I would like to keep that a good end to at least this formal part today, and then, of course, there's all the discussion. Well, let's thank Peter for his nice overview of these various topics involved in quantum physics.